Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about Google, the outcome of the years-long court case, and what it means for users, the company, and the government's attempts to rein in Silicon Valley. The recent ruling was seen as a victory for the tech giant, which is not required to sell Chrome. New York Times technology reporter David McCabe has covered the Google search antitrust lawsuit since before it was filed in 2020. His most recent article on the topic was titled, Google Avoids Harshest Penalties in Landmark Search Monopoly Ruling. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Thank you for having me.
So this lawsuit spanned years. The Justice Department brought the case and wanted the court to fix Google's monopoly when it came to searching. Can you summarize each side of the argument here for us?
So this case dates back to 2020 when it was filed, and it concerns that Google product that most of your listeners know, the search engine. And the government had claimed that Google had paid billions and billions of dollars to other companies, companies that make web browsers and smartphones like Apple and Samsung, to give its search engine basically prime placement. So if you search on your iPhone, for example, in Safari, the automatic search engine is Google. And the government said, the Justice Department, along with a number of states, said that effectively this gave Google a total advantage over other search engines by putting it right in front of users, and that in turn allowed them to get more users and use that data to make the search engine better, which only entrenched their power. And Google said, no, we've invested a ton of money in this search engine, and the reason people choose it is because it's better.
Yeah. So what exactly did the judge decide, and why is it considered a win for Google? Is it a loss for the government?
So what's important to know about this case is it was divided into two phases. Mm-hmm. And the first phase answered was the judge answering the question, did Google break the antitrust laws? And that concluded there was a trial in 2023. There was a ruling last year. And the judge found that, in fact, they had broken antitrust laws. It was a real loss for Google. They were found to have acted as a monopolist, to have illegally maintained a monopoly in search. And the judge really bought into the government story, the one I just explained. But then it triggered a second phase of the trial, what's called a quote-unquote remedies phase, where they try and figure out what measures should be put in place to fix this monopoly. And that's where Google was able to eke out what has been seen as a victory for the company in a very measured, cautious ruling.
Okay. So, and basically, it was said that Google doesn't have to give up their Chrome browser, but they have to stop paying to have it be in so many places? Is that right?
Well, so they don't even have to stop paying. So this is a pretty wonky, if you thought the first phase of the trial that did they break the law was complicated, the second phase, the what do we do about it, was even more complicated for the judge, because it's a highly technical set of questions about basically how do you change the dynamics of how people search for information online. The government had asked that Google be forced to sell its Chrome web browser. Billions of people use it around the world. I'm sure a lot of your listeners use it. And the government said that Chrome was essentially a way that Google hoovered up search traffic. But the judge said, you know, the law doesn't allow me to go this far. You don't have to sell Chrome. The government also asked that Google stop paying those companies, Apple and Samsung, for that prime real estate for their search engine. And the judge said, actually, you can keep paying for that prime real estate, but he put restrictions on the contracts. Like, for example, they have to be able to renegotiate them once a year. The idea being that they become a little less restrictive and a little more limited. And then finally, the government had asked that Google be forced to share its search results with competitors because its search results are seen as better than its competitors. So that's, you know, a disadvantage for the competitors. And that they have to share a lot of the data, the information that underlies their search results. And the judge kind of came down the middle here. He said, you do have to share the search results for the period of, you know, the judgment, but you can do it on the terms that you already, you know, offer these commercial deals. And he said, you do have to share some of your data. The top level of what's called the search index, which is like imagine a giant map of the internet that Google, uses to search for answers. But you don't have to share everything. So you don't have to turn over all of the secret sauce. And so, Google still says they have some concerns about what this means for privacy, but they certainly avoided the worst possible fate in this case.
Okay, so the way I'm understanding that is like Google is better at Googling than all the other search engines, for a lack of a better way to say it. And so now they have to like tell the other search engines how they do it a little bit. Is that what that means?
Yeah, or they at least need to give the other search engines the ingredients, some of the ingredients in their successful recipe, right? And certainly, should these deals come to fruition where other companies can license the search results, that immediately would improve the quality of some of their competitors. So it's a question of how that data gets used, and it seems like other search engines are still sort of assessing how they can use this information and this data. And I would say, not just other search engines, but also artificial intelligence companies as well.
Right. At this hearing, or at a hearing, not this most recent ruling, but at a hearing in May, the judge acknowledged that some of these questions are very hard. Do you think, like, I mean, that's an understatement. Is this judge a tech expert? Did they understand what they were doing in this ruling?
Well, I can't speak necessarily to what was going on in the judge's head, but I can tell you what he said, which is he said, "I'm not an expert in this business. I'm not an expert in artificial intelligence, and it's important that a court, when being asked to consider such measures that could have such an effect on consumers, on the economy, that they act with you, that a court acts with humility." And he said that's what he did. I will say though, for context. For your listeners, this judge did have a real education in this stuff, right? He has spent now many years hearing testimony from some of the best experts in the world on this, from tons of executives inside Google, but also people from OpenAI and Microsoft and all of these other companies. And so, he said he's not an expert, but it is certainly true that he received a significant education in the economics of this, the law, and the technical way that search works.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the ruling in the landmark Google antitrust case with New York Times reporter David McCabe. Should I, as a Google user, be concerned about privacy of my information? Is giving information to other search engines, is that the part where they're worried about privacy?
Well, that's what Google said at the trial, at the remedies trial. Of course, they were trying to avoid having to share this data. And the judge has appointed a technical committee to oversee, or the judge has established, I'm sorry, a technical committee to oversee this judgment. I imagine some of these questions will be litigated, potentially before the court. So it seems like certainly that area of privacy and what it means for Google's users will be something that the company is going to keep calling to the court's attention and continues to talk about. I should say also, it's widely expected that they will appeal the underlying decision. The Justice Department could, in theory, appeal parts of this remedies decision. And so I think in terms of the impact on consumers, there is certainly the question of what happens if these take effect, but there's also a question of when will these take effect, if they're going to be appealed.
Well, and then there's also generative AI, like ChatGPT, changing technology faster than the court system can keep up. So, are users going to be turning away from Google search engine anyway? Because there's so many other generative AI and ChatGPT. I mean, it's not Google doesn't seem to have the monopoly on the AI searching ability. So, what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, this was this sort of incredible dynamic in this case, which is that between when it was filed in 2020 and now, there has been the growth of these AI chatbots. And it happened really, I mean, ChatGPT was released at the end of 2022. The case goes to trial, in fall 2023. So these two things really played out in parallel, and this judge had to incorporate the changes in the world into the way he saw the case. And so you're right, there's been an explosion of chatbots. You mentioned some of them. There is a ton of investment, both by venture capitalists and some of these startups, but also by big established companies, including Google, in building the infrastructure that's required to offer AI products. And the judge looked at that and he said, maybe the game has changed, that it is possible that there are now products that could compete for Google's market share in search basically on the merits, that maybe these chatbots are a new and better way for consumers to search, and that that will help challenge Google's dominance. And that was actually sort of it seemed to be at least partially decisive in his decision not to ban these payments to Apple and Samsung, because he said, well, maybe there's a world in which Google offers Apple, billions of dollars, but Apple looks at another product and says, this is just a better product for our users, and decides to make it the automatic search engine. And more broadly, Google was able to present to the judge evidence that they are not the dominant chatbot in the market in the way that they do on search. So that's right.
Yeah. The idea of Googling something just became a part of life. It's like saying Kleenex for facial tissues and Band-Aids for an adhesive bandage. But if you are, and if you live your life as an anti-monopoly type person, should people in the world stop saying Google it?
Well, I'm not here to tell anybody what to say, but this ended up being sort of the decisive question of this remedies phase of the trial was, is Google already under challenge from these new chatbots, right? Is it possible that Google's status as sort of the undefeated brand name of looking for information online is suddenly at risk for the first time in decades? Or are they going to use their power, and this is what the government said, are they going to use their power in search to try and open up space to dominate the market for artificial intelligence, and specifically for these chatbots that provide you with information?
So Google's AI is called Gemini, and I can never imagine myself saying Gemini it, if my kid wants me to look up something. So I don't know. It feels like Google's dominance in that area isn't there right now.
Yeah, I mean, that is what they said at the trial. They presented data, that showed that Gemini, which is their sort of marquee chatbot, as you said, did not was not the leading chatbot. I think what the Justice Department argued was that perhaps Google will be able to sort of take their dominance in search, build their AI features in, and use that as basically a head start. But certainly, so far, that has not led them to be the leading chatbot.
You had an interview on The Daily, the New York Times podcast that we air here on our station as well on this topic. And you talked about how it speaks to how difficult this is for the court system to keep up with rapidly changing technology. How complicated are these legal questions going to get? I mean, are we going to just AI has evolved so quickly. You mentioned that it kind of came on the scene in 2022, so it's here and so fast. Can courts keep up with this?
Well, that is the big question, and in many ways it takes on a lot of extra weight because the United States government has not passed new regulations largely for these products, and ha has largely pursued instead these cases in courts to try and police the power of these big tech companies. And I think in this case what we saw is that the time it took to bring this case to trial and get a judgment was in fact outpaced by the speed at which Silicon Valley has been operating. It's also worth noting that the government took a look at Google's search business more than a decade ago, decided not to bring a case. So I think for some people in the anti-monopoly world, as you said, that's sort of the big what if, right? What if a case like this had been brought, 10 years before ChatGPT was introduced? But that, is a total hypothetical. And so yeah, so in this case, the judge was had to confront the fact that this trial had been sort of outpaced by the speed at which Silicon Valley was developing these AI products.
Why did it take so long? Was part of it that, AI interrupted things, or the Justice Department changed hands, or is it just, or do cases like this just take years and that's how it is?
It depends on the part of the country that these cases are filed in often. So just, for contrast, this case took about, let's say 5 years to go from filing to judgment. There's another case against Google filed in the Eastern District of Virginia by the Justice Department where they have successfully argued that they have a monopoly over some advertising technology. That court, the Eastern District of Virginia, is known as the quote unquote rocket docket because cases move faster. And so that case went to trial much faster. I think it was about 18 months or so. So it depends a bit on how fast the judge moves. These cases are very high stakes. They're quite resource intensive. And so, it's not like between 2020 and 2025 they were doing nothing in this case. There's discovery, they're digging up evidence, they're taking depositions, they are arguing on paper basically to prepare the judge for the arguments that they'll hear. at trial. But you know, a lot of it does come down to how fast does the judge want the case to move. And in this case, you know, he was quite deliberative, but it did take 5 years.
Deliberative, yes, another word for slow, but we got it. Just as a final question, is this done now, or is Google going to appeal? Does this continue for more years?
Google has promised to appeal that original decision that found that they had broken the law. You know, there are various permutations of how an appeal could work. Obviously, the government could appeal. You know, there are some of their losses here, but I don't think they've said that they will, though they said they're assessing options. So, you know, this really could end up mired in the court for years, and that means that these remedies could be paused for years.
We have been talking about the ruling in the landmark Google antitrust case with New York Times reporter David McCabe. David, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate it.
And coming up, we're going to talk about a British tech pioneer who advocated for women in computer software jobs by creating her own billion-dollar company. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Stephanie Shirley is a name not many of us in the United States are familiar with. But a recent New York Times obituary gave the British tech pioneer, who died in August, her due, and explains how generations of women everywhere benefited from her innovation and advocacy. She was a role model to a legion of women, including our guest today, Dame Wendy Hall, the Regius Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Hall.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I wanted to start with some audio we have of Stephanie Shirley from 2015. She gave a TED Talk at the time she was 81, and she's talking about what she accomplished in the tech arena.
We pioneered the concept of women going back into the workforce after a career break. We pioneered all sorts of new flexible work methods, job shares, profit sharing, and eventually co-ownership when I took a quarter of the company into the hands of the staff at no cost to anyone but me.
So, Wendy, she mentions a lot of concepts in that clip, job sharing, flex time, profit sharing. She was truly ahead of her time, wasn't she?
Absolutely ahead of her time. I mean, we're talking here in the 60s when she did this. Yeah.
So she started a software business called Freelance Programmers at her dining room table. Can you tell us more about the start of that? What did the company do?
Well, I think you need to go back a little, if you don't mind, because she, as you know, she arrived on the Kinder transport. She arrived in the UK with no money and no, couldn't speak English. And long story short, she didn't have a formal higher education. She went to work for our post office, where she started to work with computers. And this is in the 50s, 1950s, very early. She met her husband there, Ray Shirley, and she's not Ray, but she met her husband there, Mr. Shirley, Derek, actually. And when she got married, she had to leave the post office. It was civil service. And in those days, married women could not stay working at the civil service. I mean, that's amazing just for you and I to think about.
Yeah.
So, and then it, she went to work for a computer company, but then she became pregnant, had her son, And it, as the story, as you know, that her son became was born very autistic. And we, in those days, people didn't know what autism was, but she knew she had to stay at home to look after him. She was determined to be able to work from home. And that was how the company started. And then she wanted to help women like herself who wanted to work in computing but needed to work from home. And remember, this is the days of the mainframes. So, you know, it wasn't just like having a computer connected to the internet. This was where you had to send off punch cards or paper tape to somewhere to run the program and then get it back when, you know. So it was a very different world to the world today, but she was determined to help women to be able to do this type of work from home. And that's how it started.
And, you know, we're talking about British tech pioneer Stephanie Shirley, but you and others sometimes call her Dame Steve. What is the story behind?
No, never Dame Steve.
No.
we call her Steve. And when, yeah, she's Steve Shirley to me. And the reason that happened was because back in the day, in the 60s, when she was running this company and getting work for her army of women who were working from home to do, you know, systems engineering contracts, she would call and say, "I'm Stephanie Shirley," and they wouldn't put her through to the people who were giving out the contracts. They assumed she was the secretary or and wanted to talk to her boss. So she, in fact, I think it was her husband's idea, but she changed her name officially by deed poll to Steve. So she ended up with the interesting a male Christian name and an effectively a female last name, but she became Steve Shirley, and I always knew her as Steve. But when she got her damehood from the Queen, she decided she wanted to be Dame Stephanie. So if you know, she used the title Dame because Dame goes with the Christian name. So she was Dame Stephanie, but always Steve to us. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess once you got her on the phone, though, maybe you would realize that she wasn't a Steve, but at least would that get her through to a part
that
of the call?
Would get her through to the right person. That right. was the idea, and either in person or on the phone, yeah.
So you came to know Steve through the British Computer Society. She was the first female president of that society back in 1989, and you were the second female president a few years later. Can you tell me about that organization and what it was like to have a woman in charge of it?
Well, it was hasn't changed much today, actually. It was a lot of tech bros, except they were different. Two generations ago, tech bros, a lot of men in the computer world. Unfortunately, it is still very dominated by men, but she broke through. She was the first in the UK. I mean, there are her equivalents in the US, but she was the first in the UK to break through that particular glass ceiling and was elected as the first female president. And she was a very intimidating woman, I have to say. She scared both men and women. She was an absolute sweetheart. She was a lovely lady when you got to know her, but she was very intimidating. She was determined to get her way. And when I got to know her because she was, you know, a generation and someone I looked up to, got to know her when she was president. And then I started climbing my way up through the organization. And got to know her when I was on, first of all, on the council. And then when I was elected as president, she emailed me and she said, it was an order, not an invitation. She said, "I'm going to tell you how to be president." she took me out to dinner. And that was the bit she meant of me for quite a bit after that. But I was really quite intimidated by her at first, but we became very good friends over the years. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how she influenced your career.
Well, I mean, like I have several strong women mentors, and it was really making me realize it was possible that I could achieve what I wanted to achieve, because we all sort of suffer from this imposter syndrome. And well, I know men do as well, but I think women do particularly, because there aren't many of us around in the computing world. So you always feel a bit like an imposter. And she just made me realize that I could achieve what I wanted to achieve. And and gave me lots of tips about how to go about it, how to be a female leader in a male-dominated world. And she was just truly inspirational and amazing. I mean, I find it hard. I'm missing her hugely, but it's like these words are just natural to talk about her as a really inspirational person. And she inspired men and women alike, but
this
she's particularly about women. Yeah.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about British tech pioneer Stephanie Shirley, who passed away in August. And our guest is Dame Wendy Hall from the University of Southampton, who knew Stephanie Shirley well. So her earliest memories, she left her home country. She boarded a train in Vienna. She was a childhood refugee, part of the Kinder transport you mentioned earlier, which saved nearly 10,000 Jewish children from Nazi Europe. Did she share those experiences and how it shaped her? Did she talk about it?
Oh, yes. In fact, I would recommend anyone to read her autobiography, Let It Go. That was the first time, she didn't go on and on about it, but that was the first time I heard the story, really, and how it affected her. She was 5 and her sister, Renata, was 8 when her parents put them on the boat in 1939. And can you imagine what that was like? She spoke no English. As I said, she had no money. And it must have been an incredibly traumatic experience. And there's two things I would say. One is that I don't suppose at 5 she knew what was happening. But a lot of the children who went on those boats were saved themselves. But, of course, their parents, they never saw their parents again. Stephanie and Renata were fostered by a family in the Midlands, and they had a very happy childhood. But her parents actually survived, and they met after the war, but that bond was never rebuilt. She was never able to rebuild the bond with her birth parents again. And I think that speaks volumes for what it did to them. And the other thing she would always say, and in this time where immigration and refugee status and asylum seekers is such a big thing, she would always say, Great Britain saved me, right, from a terrible fate. And I wanted to be worth saving.
Mm. Wow.
And such a wonderful thing to say. She always gave back. She was fiercely proud to be British.
Yeah. England was her adopted country. How well known are her accomplishments in England? Is it just the United States where her name is not well known?
I wouldn't say she's, it's not a name that the average person on the street would know. She's very well known in the community. And she founded, the other thing is that she became one of the top female philanthropists in the UK. She was absolutely determined. Her son Giles died, and she was so that he was her life, really. She wanted to give money to the cause of autism. He died in his 30s. And after that, basically, she and her husband decided they were going to give all the money away. A bit Bill Gates-like, we are going to make sure we can live comfortably into our old age, but we want every penny to go to good causes. And mostly, she founded the Oxford Internet Institute, and she founded the Worshipful Company of IT, Information Technologists, which is one of the London livery associations. But most importantly, she gave to the autism. She built a school for autistic children, and that gave so much to the cause of finding cures and treatments for autism. Mm-hmm. And she actually said to me, I can't remember, I saw her quoted, she was so happy when she was out of the Sunday Times rich list.
Oh, she gave her money away and off the list?
Which meant she was giving her money away at a good enough rate. Ah. Yeah.
That's a lovely thing to be remembered for as well, in addition to all her tech accomplishments.
Yes, exactly.
Now, you mentioned this earlier about the working from home thing. So she led an all-women team that designed the black box on the Concorde. They did this all while working from home. But working from home is a popular concept now. But is that something?
It wasn't in those days.
Yeah. Did she invent it? Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure I mean, yes, I think she was one of the true pioneers of it, particularly for women, women bringing up families or caring for people in their families who wanted to continue to work. Actually, she was very proud that F International, as it became known, designed the black box for Concorde. It's one of her, examples of what they did. But I wouldn't necessarily say that was an all-women team because she was a bit defeated by the Equal Opportunities Act in 1972, when it became illegal to advertise jobs just for one sex or the other, or for anyone. It had to be equal,
So she
and
had
so
to employ men.
she had to start employing men. Yes. And of course, as you heard in that TED talk, she basically made the people in the company partners, so that when she sold the company and made a lot of money out of it, they all made. She made, I think, something like 70 of her employees, some of which might have been men, made them millionaires when she did that.
Do you think that some of the concepts she pioneered would have been implemented sooner industry-wide if a man had pioneered them? Or is that why that's why she changed her name to Steve? So because she knew she had something here.
Well, no, I think it's the other way around. She changed her name to Steve so she could make the best of what she was doing in a time when being a man was what opened the doors, and it was assumed that a woman was always in a subservient position. She pioneered the fact. And almost the changing of the name was part of that pioneering, was that, we're just as good, but actually we have to pretend we're not, sort of thing. And she, so I think it was the fact that it wasn't so much the working at home that was important. It was women working in that space, in the computing space, and just getting on and doing things, getting really big contracts and delivering them in a mostly female or mostly women workplace. And we've lost a bit of that, I mean, AI, that's my world these days, and we're going backwards. There's less and less women involved in this world, and I'm still passionate about trying to make sure that women's voices are heard in something that affects society so much. And that's what Steve's all about.
What would you say her lasting contribution will be, if she was remembered for
What,
one thing?
of all of them? Of all of them? I would say it would have to be, it's a choice between empowering women and wanting to make the best of her life by doing really well and then giving it all away. And but suppose, oh, that's a hard choice.
You can have two. That's fine.
No, I would say actually the philanthropy is the really big thing because that is a lesson for everybody. And I think that as part of that, it was empowering women to achieve their best was and to know that they could is her legacy.
Well, I want to give her the final word. So we're going to play one more piece from her TED talk that she gave about 10 years ago.
When I started my company of women, the men sort of said, "How interesting." But of course, it only works because it's small. And later, as it became sizable, they sort of accepted, "Yes, it is sizable now, but of no strategic interest." And later, when it was a company valued at over $3 billion, and I'd made 70 of the staff into millionaires, they sort of said, "Well done, Steve."
That was the voice of British tech pioneer Stephanie Shirley from a TED talk she gave about 10 years ago. Stephanie Shirley, who called herself Steve to get a leg up in a man's world, the tech pioneer passed away in August. And our guest has been Dame Wendy Hall from the University of Southampton, talking about her role model. Thank you for your time today, Wendy.
Amy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me.
And you're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit,
That's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Apple plans to unveil its latest phone this afternoon. We could see more than one model as well, including a thinner phone and some new colors. Here to walk us through the possible changes to the new iPhone 17 is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So just to start off, this whole thing where every year there's a new phone and every year there's a new phone upgrade, are there enough improvements year over year to warrant making a new phone every year, or is it just the annual cash grab?
So it's an interesting question, right? Apple, like Google and Samsung and several other companies, they release phones every year, but the goal is not for you as the consumer to buy a new phone every year. Not everybody exists on the same upgrade cycle. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that this phone would appeal to someone who bought a phone 2 or 3 years ago. And in cases for a lot of Apple phones, it can be even, 4 or 5 years ago. And so now they are ready to upgrade, and this is the thing that they upgrade to. There are absolutely people who are gadget obsessed, who kind of line up for the latest and greatest every single year. But the release cycle here is that that's not its original intent. The original intent really comes from when all of our contracts for T-Mobile and AT&T and Verizon and all those would exist on those multi-year cycles where you would buy your phone from a carrier. So there needed to be something new each year, despite, the audience being quite cyclical in nature.
Okay, so I can be content with my iPhone 14 and just listen to you tell me about the iPhone 17 for now.
There's a very real chance that you will remain perfectly happy with your phone after the new phone is announced today.
Okay, so on to the iPhone 17 then. There's leaked photos, there's rumors from industry analysts. It likely won't be just one phone, a base model, and then some other versions. So can you tell us what you know, what you can predict about this afternoon?
Sure. So Apple's release cycle for the last couple of years has included what they would consider a base model phone, which would be called the iPhone 17, and then a pro version of that phone that likely has some improved camera capabilities, possibly a larger battery, or some additional new technology that Apple would announce later today, and then a Pro Max version of that phone, which is all of the great camera and advanced features in the Pro, but in a much larger size. For folks who are big fans of having the biggest possible screen with the largest possible battery. That's been Apple's release cycle for the last couple of years, and it's proven to be quite popular.
Okay, so there's also the idea that it might be aluminum instead of titanium. Does that mean it's lighter?
It certainly has the potential to be aluminum. There are some listening today who may remember that Apple used to be quite fond of the idea of using aircraft-grade aluminum in their phones. And then there were a couple of phones that had some difficulties not bending in people's pockets. And so Apple made the switch to titanium, and that is kind of been the way that things have gone for quite some time now. So it's likely that we're going to see a phone that is a slightly different shape, but still have all of the same kind of key features to Apple, and will likely end up at the very least being presented as slightly thinner. As with most phones now, that there's still a great big bump that comes out of the back where your camera goes. That doesn't make the phone any easier to slide in and out of your pocket, despite claims of being thinner.
Mm. And also, there's the idea of new colors. I know that you're a fan of different colors for phones. So what has been leaked about these colors?
Yeah, so Apple has released, at least one new color as a part of a rotation, each year. There has been, and it's not, in any particular direction on the color wheel. Sometimes it's a really nice green, sometimes it's a pink, sometimes it's a rose gold. It really just depends on whatever the theme that Apple has chosen for the year. And it looks like one of the key ones this year may end up being a light blue.
Are you going to get the light blue then?
That will very much depend on what it looks like in person.
Okay. Are they going to leave my charging port alone? Or are they going to change that again?
Charging port's not going to go anywhere. USB Type-C is certainly the law of the land for at least the next little while. We don't have any other technologies that will go alongside that. However, it is very likely that Apple will announce some improvements to how these phones charge wirelessly. There have been quite a few sets of technologies that have come out over the last couple of years that have made it so that batteries can charge faster without having any significant degradation in the battery's life. So it is likely that if you do get a new phone this year that it will, and you use a wireless charger, that you will notice it charges faster, than it did, your previous phone. But really only if you're a fan of that particular kind of technology. Not everybody uses wireless charging.
And you mentioned another rumor relates to that camera bump in the back where, that's what makes it hard to slide the phone in and out of your pocket. Well, depending on your case, I guess, but the camera bump. What is this rumor that it might stretch across the entire phone?
Yes. So, most folks that have seen an iPhone recently, they're familiar with the kind of square bulge in the back of the phone that allows for those three cameras to exist in that triangular foundation, or two cameras if you have the non-pro version of the phone. The idea here is by taking those cameras and stress them out in a line, they can fit some additional technology in them that may make it so that you can zoom quite a bit further without losing any quality of your image. And that's something that Google and Samsung have leaned really hard on in the last year, is being able to have these crazy high numbers, like 50 times optical zoom and things like that, that Apple isn't likely to try and replicate, but will certainly, make a case for some improved optics in their cameras.
Do we know anything about price, or we won't find out until this afternoon?
We won't find out until this afternoon, but one of the persistent rumors around this phone is that the baseline of the phone will actually be $100 cheaper than the baseline for last year, making it $699 instead of $799, which is an interesting change in a world where folks are really concerned about tariffs making their phones more expensive. Mm-hmm. And Apple, does not exclusively manufacture in the U.S., so there's always some associated risk there when it comes to tariffs for individual components. So in a world where things appear to be getting more expensive, a base phone that is $100 cheaper than the version that was available last year would be an interesting feat for Apple to pull off. Apple, however, not usually concerned with being the cheapest company around. They're aware mm-hmm. that their brand, allows them to charge at a higher premium. So I wouldn't necessarily count on that as being 100% real.
Okay. Yeah. And then what about the storage, though? Because I always pay more than the base phone so that I can have more storage.
The last couple of generations, Apple has tried to make some changes as to, how much storage is available on that base model. But at the same time, as cameras get better and as phones become more featureful in their cameras, every photo and every video just takes up more space. Mm-hmm. So typically starting with if it's a phone you're going to keep for quite a while, and if you are fond of taking pictures and recording video, my usual recommendation is to go with the 1 gigabyte or 1 terabyte model of mm-hmm. the phone.
Yeah, that 64 thing from a long time ago, 64 gig, doesn't cut it at all. So
that's right.
All right. So the announcement will be later today. And then next week, we can talk about what actually comes about and see if all your predictions are correct or not. Does that sound good?
That's exactly right. In addition to that, if the phones and not just phones, but likely also watches and headphones that get announced today, Apple typically makes the announcement on a Tuesday and makes the original pre-orders for those devices available that Friday. Hmm. So there may be the ability to pre-order this phone before you and I talk again.
All right. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Smart home technology offers a lot of conveniences, and up until recently, it was pretty secure. But in the age of AI, has brought some new vulnerabilities, including taking over home devices. Tell me about some of these vulnerabilities if you have some smart home technology.
So one of the big concerns around any smart home technology is somebody else controlling the things in your home without you being aware. This could mean something as simple as a prank that you play on a friend that allows you to change the lights in their bedroom when they're not expecting it. But it could also be as dangerous as unlocking your front door in a way that is silent without somebody being aware that it is happening, or turning off security cameras or turning off storage on security cameras. All of these things that are connected to the same smart home, the vulnerability there is that if somebody gets access to the central thing that controls everything, then you are no longer safe. There have been a group of researchers that have been looking into ways in which using AI to gather, you know, all of your smart home tech into one piece of software so that you can come in and say, you know, I am home to your smart home of choice, and have all of these different things kind of all turn on at the same time. Maybe your thermostat changes to, you know, your ideal setting, and the lightings in your house change, and things like that all kind of happen, you know, as a group because you have set it up to do so. These researchers have found that there are ways in which AI prompts can be manipulated to add instructions into those kind of groups of commands. And that can be done in a way that is quite difficult to find and is very difficult to find a record of, which could mean that somebody could send you an email and you know, by opening that email, you have introduced software into your home that made it so that those AI commands now have additional instructions that could make you less safe.
Yeah, the article in CNET that I read called this promptware. Is that the right term?
Yeah, the idea is that it is malware hidden inside of AI prompts. So, yeah.
So, and some of the promptware is zero click, meaning like the old way you messed everything up was you got an email that you didn't know and you clicked on a bad URL and everything went wrong. But now it's zero click, like Gemini or whatever, you know, AI just has to read it. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And those instructions can include, you know, going to websites that allow you to, that allow for more malicious code to be downloaded. It could mean that, you know, the hardware in your home is suddenly acting as a Bitcoin mining machine for someone who does not live there without you being aware that it is happening. So suddenly you have, you know, pieces of electronics in your home that just aren't performing the way that they used to, and there doesn't seem to be anything wrong. And it is because, you know, all of these additional commands are being run in the background to take advantage of the door that you have opened for them accidentally.
So what can we do about it? You know, the CNET article has 5 steps to follow to stop promptware threats. What's your biggest advice here?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we're not in a position where it's very easy to find some of these threats. So one of the biggest reasons that we know about it in the first place is because these researchers happen to be on the good side, and they went to Google immediately and said, hey, this is a vulnerability we found. And so if you are using Google's Gemini, it's already been announced by Google that this has been patched, and they don't think this is going to be an immediate problem. However, you know, a lot of the recommendations from security experts introduce kind of other problems in and of themselves. So the biggest one is to make sure that your software is always updated, which is a great idea just sort of generally, you know, alongside that is, you know, not accepting messages from unknown sources. The problem with both of those being, you know, kind of the top set of instructions is that means that you kind of always have to know when there is new software updates available, or if you have a piece of hardware that does not have, you know, a new software update available for it, unless you buy the next version, then you are kind of stuck in an infinite money loop to make sure that your home is safe. And accidents happen. Like, there is no such thing as a person who is 100% perfectly secure on the internet. So this is certainly an issue that is going to require quite a bit of monitoring over the next year.
One of the steps you can follow to protect yourself from these threats said to disable AI in your email, calendar, and chat apps. But I feel like part of that is the point, like to be able to say to my calendar to do something for me. That's why you want this smart home and the AI.
That is completely correct. And also, there are fewer and fewer tools that allow you to completely disable AI inside of those tools, especially ones that are managed by Google and Apple and you know, some of these places. It is not yet 100% impossible, but it is getting more difficult as software updates come in.
Mm. All right, we'll move onto our final topic because it's happier than malware in my smart home. We're going to talk about robot vacuums. What do some robot vacuums and cars have in common? Well, it's four-wheel drive. Russell, why does a robot vacuum need four-wheel drive?
Well, this is actually kind of an amazing solution to a problem that doesn't get talked about a whole lot, is that one of the biggest reasons that robot vacuums fail is because they run over a thing that they weren't supposed to. Maybe there was a cable on the ground that wasn't there before, or a kid, you know, dropped a bunch of Legos, or, you know, a dog had an accident in the house. Like, there are, you know, a whole bunch of kind of nightmare scenarios when it comes to robot vacuums that are cleaning the house You know, while you're not there. I have had one personally that flung itself down a flight of stairs and then suddenly was not a robot vacuum anymore. You know, there are a lot of different things that can happen to these in daily use because, you know, people are kind of messy by nature. So the biggest one is what happens when it runs over a thing. In most cases, a robot vacuum will just stop or try and go around it or, you know, either or pick it up and cause a mess. What a lot of what several companies are now trying is making sure that the wheels that control those things are sort of independently controlled in a way that is very similar to like a Jeep's four-wheel drive to make sure that it can kind of climb over stuff. An important part of that is making sure that it is not actively running the vacuum while it is running over stuff, so that it can move from one place to another without causing any significant harm to the machine or the things around it.
That now the one that was featured in this article has a really long name. I love yes. things with long names. What are we supposed to call it? Because I'm not reading this whole thing.
I am just calling it the X11.
The X11. Yes. Okay. And it's pricey though, like $1,500, right?
Yes. These machines, you know, this is right around the time between now and CES in January, where these companies will announce these robot vacuums that are, you know, kind of the highest end. They include a lot of technology in them, but they are very expensive pieces of machinery. And a lot of that comes down to them knowing that they're only going to make and sell a couple of these, but that technology eventually becomes less expensive and goes down to some of the more budget-friendly models.
All right. And just to end on, there's another company that's trying to make a vacuum that can climb stairs. Is that true?
Yes, there is a robot vacuum that is trying to really, you know, kind of lean into the whole four-wheel drive thing and make it so that it can climb up and down stairs, especially if you, you know, kind of live in a house that is quite tall or narrow. And so, you know, being able to only clean one floor means that you need to own multiple robot vacuums. That is a proposed solution that I'm one of those things that I really am going to need to see for myself before I believe.
I carry my vacuum up and down the stairs. Okay, we'll just leave it there. Thanks to Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.